and welcome once again to the Cinephiles, where we're doing this sad duty that we have to do every once in a while. This one, I gotta say, is more of a celebration. We lost the great Olivia de Havilland. She's the last of the golden age actors to pass. You know, we commemorated Kirk Douglas, who was just about the same age, a couple of years younger, just 6 months ago with Spartacus. And, you know, I just wanted to take a moment maybe to talk about this era that is passing. You know, the world was so different when Olivia de Havilland was a star from how it is today. You know, she's part of the studio system. And I, you know, I looked up, I didn't know a whole lot about her, and I looked up some of her history, and she is a fascinating person.
Yeah.
So her mom was an actress. Her mom went to RADA and was in the theater. And so Olivia was not only raised taking ballet classes and singing classes, but she was forced to recite Shakespeare as a five-year-old kid.
You know? Yeah. Not a negative. Not a negative, I think. It's good to be cultured and educated at a young age. And, you know, we've seen that people who are educated, for the most part, have a better life. So getting a jump on it younger is certainly a way to go.
Well, and it's also going like, this is the world you're going to go into.
Yeah,
you know?
True.
And here's what I didn't know is I knew she was born in England. What I didn't know is that she grew up right near me. She actually, her family moved to the San Francisco Bay Area, and she was down in Los Gatos, which is where my uncle and my cousins live, just in the down in the peninsula. And she was acting in plays. Her first play was, you know, as a kid, acting in the community theater production of Alice in Wonderland. And then she acted in, she went to Mills College, which again is in the Bay Area. And she got cast as Puck in Midsummer Night's Dream, which is pretty cool. But, you know, you played in college plays. I played in college plays. What we didn't have was that Max Reinhardt, the director, did not come to our college plays. And Max Reinhardt, the director, wasn't just about to do a production of Midsummer Night's Dream at the Hollywood Bowl.
Right, right.
And well, he cast her as Hermia, to understudy Hermia. So she gets discovered acting in the play at Mills College. And, of course, as they go to prepare for this production at the Hollywood Bowl, the leads drop out. And so suddenly she goes from college production of Midsummer Night's Dream to production of Midsummer Night's Dream at the Hollywood Bowl. Can you imagine that?
Pretty incredible. And, you know, that's the way life is. Sometimes when your destiny is there for you, the doors kind of open up, and it's about whether you can walk through them or not. And clearly she could and had the talent to do so. And, you know, I'm sure she wowed them in that production. I was not there to see it. It was a school night. I couldn't go. Yeah. But I'm sure
tickets were very expensive.
Tickets were very expensive. It was at least 25 cents. But yeah, so it was so. You know, I'm sure it was an incredible thing to witness, and certainly from there going into what she went into in film and what have you. And I want to correct you real quick, Steve. She was born in Japan, actually, in Tokyo, not in England, but she was born to English parents who were living in Tokyo at the time. So, she's of English descent, though. So essentially, you were correct in that way.
Well, no, essentially, I was incorrect. That's even more interesting. And then what happened is that Warner Brothers sees this production of Midsummer and says, you know, Max Reinhardt, you should make a movie about it. And that's how she gets signed to a Warner Brothers contract. And this is the era of the studio system. This is where actors had basically no control over what they were doing. And she starts playing small parts. She acts with Betty Davis. She acts with some other people. But the big one is Errol Flynn and Captain Blood in 1935.
Yeah. This starts a relationship with her and Errol Flynn as friends for a very long time. She had a very strong, almost maternal connection to Errol, because Errol was always, you know, he was a party boy. He was getting into trouble, probably getting into situations, some warranted, some unwarranted, if you study the story of Errol Flynn. But she always felt an affinity for him. And when you read and research their connection, it's a very sweet friendship. And as you said, Steve, in that studio system time, hardly any second of time in your life was yours. And so finding someone who understood it and was also part of the grind of the studio system that you could vent to and feel a connection to must have felt so essential. It's almost like a glorified prison, You know, you have to take the lessons. You have to, you know, take whatever jobs they give you. You have to be in whatever films they tell you to be in. You have to do whatever roles they tell you to do in. You have to work with people they tell you to work with. And, you know, you got to work within that system at the time. So finding someone to connect to and someone you have great chemistry with, like Errol Flynn, must have been something that was like a light at the end of the tunnel or a respite, an oasis in her life.
Well, it's such an interesting thing because it's not, I mean, everything you say, of course, is true. And they even tried to control, they said, this is who you are. You know what I mean?
Right.
The studio system said, we see you as the second banana comedian, whatever, or we see you as the young ingenue, this thing, and we're going to plug you into that position. Mm-hmm. Is it, you know, and it's not that, you know, actors coming up today, it's not like they have total control over what movies they get to do and stuff. They don't.
Some do, but yeah,
for sure. The most part, they but don't. Not when you start out. You're going to take what you're going to get. And certainly people get typecast, but it's not like there is a Jack Warner who's just saying, this is who you are. But the relationship with Errol Flynn obviously was a great one when it comes time to do Robin Hood, which is the movie we're giving an intro to today. They brought her back, and she's just wonderful as Maid Marian in this movie.
Yeah, yeah. Really, really, it's like Margot Kidder and Lois Lane. She's the Maid Marian that everyone is compared to since. In whatever version you watch, she is the touchstone. You know, you will be compared. You will be compared to Margot Kidder, whoever plays Lois Lane, for the rest of time. And the same thing with Maid Marian. Because this film is a classic, and because it's a classic, most people watch it who are cinephiles, who love movies. They will go back and revisit this one because it's Errol Flynn at the height of his Errol Flynn-ness. It's Basil Rathbone, who's a great, great actor, who becomes someone that every Sherlock Holmes portrayal is compared to as well. And so it's interesting that they're both in this film, Maid Marian. Olivia de Havilland's Maid Marian and Basil Rathbone, who later becomes Sherlock Holmes, and all that. And then Errol Flynn's Robin Hood, yet another. Every Robin Hood is compared to that Robin Hood as well. So this is an incredible film for that reason alone, but there's also fantastic performances all throughout this thing and the visuals, which of course Joe talks about, kind of sticking with him, the reds and the greens throughout the movie, all of that. It's a very vibrant movie for a film and for a time in film when color was still something they were exploring and discovering and all of that.
Well, it's funny you make the comparison to Superman. I think that is a great comparison because it's like, This Robin Hood is compared to all other Robin Hoods that pass in the same way that Christopher Reeve Superman is compared to all other.
Yeah,
and even though they're of a certain era, I mean, Christopher Reeve Superman is definitely of the late 70s. It definitely has a warm, fuzzy feeling that we kind of have gone in a darker direction. But I think at least for our lifetimes, people are going to go, well, is he as good a Superman as Christopher Reeve?
Right.
Is he as good a Robin Hood as Errol Flynn? You know? Yeah. I think that's a great comparison. And of course, David O. Selznick sees Olivia in Robin Hood and she says, man, I would give anything to have her play Melanie in Gone with the Wind. Mm-hmm. But she's signed to Warner Brothers, so she can't do it. Because she hears this quote gets in the gossip columns or whatever. And she goes, so she goes to Jack Warner and says, hey, Jack, I don't think she called him that. Right. Mr. Warner, can you please let me out of my contract for a few months so I can go do Gone with the Wind? Because the studios did trades. That was sort of a regular thing. I'll let you use this person and you'll let me use somebody else. And Jack Warner says, no way. Mm-hmm. And so Olivia goes to his wife and asks Mrs. Warner.
Because they had been friends for a little bit, yeah.
And this is what Jack Warner said. He said, Olivia, who had a brain like a computer concealed behind those fawn-like eyes, simply went to my wife and they joined forces to change my mind. And that is how she gets on Gone with the Wind, which obviously is her most famous, I would say is the most famous movie that she's in. We've talked a lot about our feelings about that film.
Yeah.
But one thing I do remember, I think her character and her relationship with Leslie Howard? Is that what?
Yeah, Leslie Howard, yeah.
Is way more interesting to me than Scarlett. I always liked her more than Scarlett. In 42, she's nominated for Hold Back the Dawn for Best Actress. Mm-hmm. And something I didn't mention was that she has a sister who is also an actress, and that is Joan Fontaine.
Yeah. Jane Eyre herself.
Yeah. And Joan Fontaine is also nominated in the same year. It's the only time siblings have ever been nominated against each other. Fontaine is nominated for Suspicion, and she wins. And she wins the Academy Award. And apparently, Olivia's quote when it happens is, "We got it," which is great.
Yeah. You know, she was nominated for Best Supporting Actress for Gone with the Wind as well, and lost to Hattie McDaniel. So, I mean, that's in her co-star in the movie. So that's interesting at the timing as well. But her and Joan had a very long rivalry for years, a professional rivalry and personal rivalry. And that, you know, you bring siblings into Hollywood. Sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't. But certainly both of them laid a claim to their they were completely different actresses, yet siblings. So it was always interesting to see them and watch their work and see how different they were through the years, you know? And it's, the thing is, Olivia, after the contract is done too, and this speaks to what Jack Warner, the quote you just read, Steve, when Olivia is done with the contract, the 7-year contract, Jack Warner goes to her and says, like, "You're still under contract to me in my mind. You're still under," and she's like, "No." And he's like, "Well, no, you're going to do what?" And she said, "No." She takes him to the California Supreme Court. She takes a case against this idea of the studio system to the California, a female actress. Let's get this straight, because that's a very strong thing to point out. A female actress takes Jack Warner, this powerful mogul, to the Supreme Court to get out of this contract and get out of this idea that she needs to be, you know, held to this contract for 7 calendar years. And she ends up winning the case in the California Supreme Court. So pretty incredible stuff, man.
Well, and what I love is Jack Warner's reasoning of why he could hold her was she had refused to do a couple of movies. And so he said, "You're not allowed to do that. You owe me 6 more months."
Right. Did you exercise your free will? Oh, hell no. I own you. Yeah.
She wins 2 Academy Awards in her career. She turned down the role of Blanche DuBois in Streetcar, which is crazy. And then she goes to Cannes in the early 50s and falls in love there, falls in love with France. Mm-hmm. And as her career is beginning to wane, it's much, much harder for actresses of her age to get good roles in the late 50s and early 60s. In 65, she was the president of the Cannes Film Festival. Mm-hmm. She's the first woman ever to do it, which is really cool. And then, you know, she was acting in TV up until the late 80s.
Mm-hmm. 88 was her last credit, I think.
Yeah. Finally retired. What I didn't know is, you know, there was just that Betty and Joan thing on FX. She sued them for for portraying her. She sued FX at the age of 101.
Don't mess with the lady. Don't mess with Olivia de Havilland. She is not just this nice little waifish, because she is, like you said, a computer behind those steel eyes, man. It's great.
Well, I mean, and you got to be. You think about a woman coming into the studio system in the mid-30s, a very young woman, and having to at least try to control her own destiny.
Yeah.
And I think in a weird way that relates to the movie that we're seeing today, which is talking about today, which is Robin Hood, where when we meet Maid Marian, she buys into the system. You know, she buys into what's going on, and then she has to learn that what she's been raised to believe is not what's really happening. And then, man, she is the true hero of Robin Hood, in my opinion.
It's a great point, Steve. Yeah, she kind of she pushes off Prince John. She kind of goes with Robin, risks her status, risks everything, because she knows what's right. And so she wants to do, and you can see it in her eyes. And it's really when you see probably Olivia, and how can I say this correctly? Not necessarily that she isn't acting, but you get to see Olivia, like the real Olivia, in those burning moments with those eyes of hers when she's defiant, you know, when she's forceful in what she wants to have or wants to see happen. And it's great to watch that. And those are things you fall in love with when you sense the energy of a person underneath the character. That if it touches you or if it connects with you, then you are 1,000% in with that actor. And so she has that throughout this movie. And you're absolutely right. She's actually the real hero of the piece.
She rescues Robin Hood.
Yep.
And I have to say, so we're re-releasing our Robin Hood episode today. This was a really special one for me to record.
Yeah.
You know, we had Joe Mantegna as a guest. Joe had acted for me in The Assistants. We had first met him. Karen had worked on Joan of Arcadia. That was one of her very first casting jobs that he was an actor in. And he is just the loveliest, sweetest. I mean, all that stuff about stars and there can be difficult, and that is not Joe Mantegna. It was
right.
He welcomed. I mean, you remember he welcomed us into his office and
very kind,
as warm. And it was so. What was so cool about the episode was just his love for this film and for Errol Flynn, and feeling that, hearing him getting to talk about that was just, it was great.
Yeah. I mean, you could tell how much it really moved him and affected him and how much he loved this movie. Look, Steve, we're all going to get to Joe Mantegna's age one day.
I hope so.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're going to talk about, you know, the film that really did it for us. And we're going to talk about it in reverential tones and hushed tones. And it won't matter what we've accomplished. We'll be reduced back to being that kid who watched it for the first time. And you will, when you listen to this episode or re-listen to this episode, for those of you who have heard it before, catch that twinkle in Joe's voice. Catch that. You almost see it in his eye if you visualize it. Catch the twinkle in his voice when he's talking about this movie, when he slides back into that place where he was as a kid when he first discovered this movie and how it influenced him and affected him just kind of has stayed with him ever since.
I just have this image of him seeing this movie in black and white on a little TV. And I remember he told this story about him seeing it in the movie theater in color for the first time.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and reading Errol Flynn's book and that, you know, like that, you know, you and I've talked about a whole bunch of our kid movie moments where our eyes were opened up, whether it was seeing, you know, Star Wars or Star Trek or Superman, or both of us seeing Citizen Kane for the first time. Mm-hmm. And that was that moment for Joe Mantegna. And that led to his whole career. And it's so funny too, because you go like, if you were going to compare Joe Mantegna, what kind of actor is he? I don't think we would have ever come up with Errol Flynn.
No, you know? Right.
Yeah, and yet that is his inspiration. And it's just this was a special, very special episode for me. It might be the episode that I was most nervous for to record.
Oh, yeah. Well, let me tell you something, Cinephiles fans. Having been in the room with him and before it all happened, yes, this is the most nervous Steve has ever been before any recording of this show.
Well, because I didn't want to blow it. You know what I mean? Like,
right,
I know that if I stumble and with Scott Mance, you know, he might give me a little shit, but he's not going to. But if we came in not looking like pros with Joe Mantegna, or if we messed up the recording, or it was going to be bad. So I went over my notes really carefully. and we were both like, don't mess this up. And we've talked about we're trying to, you know, Joe just retired from Criminal Minds. Mm-hmm. Or didn't retire. The show ended, and so his schedule has opened up a little bit again. So I've reached out to him, and hopefully we'll have another Joe Mantegna episode on the Cinephiles. It would be so great.
I agree, 1,000%.
Yeah. So without further ado, in honor of the great Olivia de Havilland, we return to Sherwood Forest, Joe Mantegna, and the Adventures of Robin Hood.
A new year, time for new growth. Grow your education and skills with Herzing University. Our online behavioral health programs fit your schedule and time. From an 8-month diploma program in health and human services to a 36-month bachelor's in psychology. Grow your behavioral health career with us wherever you are in your education. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Visit us online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109. Online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109.
Welcome to Sherwood, my lady.
Hello and welcome once again to The Cinephiles, where each week we enter the world of a great film, we explore its themes, its history, the filmmaking, and the influence it has on us today. My name is Steve Morris. I'm a filmmaker and directing instructor in Los Angeles, California.
Hello, everyone. My name is John Rocha. I'm a voiceover actor, host of numerous shows, and occasionally an on-camera actor in California. And I say that with a little bit of shame and with our guests sitting in front of us that I can even say that. But we'll see if I make it through the podcast not going insane about it.
You could say it. I'm an occasional on-camera actor myself.
It's just a question of how occasional.
That's right. it's a relative term.
And you've already heard his voice. We're so thrilled to welcome an actor who's... I was looking at your list of credits. I can't possibly list them all here. They're way too long. But an actor who's worked extensively with David Mamet. You got a Tony for Richie Roma, which is in one of my favorite plays, Glengarry Glen Ross. And, of course, acting movies like Godfather 3, Forget Paris, The Star of CBS Criminal Minds, Fat Tony on The Simpsons, which is very important to all of us. And, of course, you acted for me in my film The Assistants. I'm very happy to welcome Joe Mantegna to The Cinephiles.
Thanks, Steve. Glad to be here.
I'm thrilled. And when we first started talking about you coming on the show, you instantly responded the movie you wanted to do was 1938, Errol Flynn, The Adventures of Robin Hood.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'm so curious. It's obvious that you have a real connection to this film. And I wonder, how did you first come to it? What is the importance of this film in your life?
You know what? How I first came to it, in a way, justifies my lack of prejudice between television and film. You know, I grew up in an era, especially being an actor, that there was this whole period for many years where you were either, if you were going to be an actor, you were either a stage actor. You had like three options. You were a stage actor, and they thought of you as that. You were a TV actor, you know, somebody who just did kind of TV shows and stuff. Or you were a film star, a film actor. And there were those three definitions, and very often that twain did not meet. Obviously, things have changed immensely today. But back then, it was like that. But what I discovered and what I've realized is that I discovered most of my favorite movies through television. Because as a kid, the kind of where I discovered movies was like on late night TV. You know, there'd be movie nights and all that on television, like at 10:30 in Chicago. This was in Chicago, back at 10:30 after the news. Chicago, the news comes out at 10, and at 10:30 they usually run movies. Or on Saturday afternoons, they'd run movies.
Right.
And so I got exposed to the movie Robin Hood. I didn't have a color TV then, you know. And
that's
so
what I was wondering, if you had seen it black and white
I saw it first in black and white, because I remember the first color TV our family had, I bought it. Because I took my dad, he'd been disabled most of his life, so we never have a lot of cash. And I remember I took a student loan to go to my first year of acting school. And I borrowed more than I needed. And I used part of the money to get a color TV for my family. Because I was still living at home. I said, hey, at least we're going to do this. Let's use some of this government money for something, you know. If the acting thing doesn't work out, at least we've got a TV.
Absolutely.
That I can pay on time with low interest. So to see it in black and white, all I could say is when I first saw the movie, it was like, you know, it was the music. I mean, first of all, you know, those were the days when themes, you know, movie themes were really movie themes, were huge orchestrations. Right. And here was this guy, Errol Flynn, and here was this whole, you know, it was just from beginning to end, it was this fantasy. I mean, it was like a Grimm's fairy tale in a way, come to life. So I got hooked on it right away, just even in the black and white version. And it was one of those things that then it progressed from there. So in other words, as I got older, so like I barely discovered the movie, I was probably, you know, 10 years old or 12 years old, let's say, you know, and was just amazed by just the fun of it and the fantasy of it. But then as I got older and got more into acting, a couple things happened. First of all, like I said, we got the color TV. So I'm sure I saw some bad kind of version of it, because the color TV back then was really bad, you know, but at least I saw it. But then I remember I was in acting school at the time, and I remember there was this theater in Chicago called the Clark Theater, and what they would do is run old movies, so I remember they advertised, we're going to have Robin Hood, and we're going to show it in the original Technicolor, you know, a print that we've kind of restored and all, and for me that was a big deal, and so I went to see that, and to see it on a big screen, in that great old Technicolor that were the reds are like jumping out at you and stuff, right. And then the music, they'd piped up the music. I mean, I was like weak in the knees seeing that version. And then from that, I got this huge interest in Errol Flynn. I started watching all his movies. And then his book, he has a book called My Wicked, Wicked Ways. And I read the book, and I got obsessed with the book to where I was actually looking, I'd go through old bookstores, and if I could find hard copies of it, I'd buy them. And what's funny is it went out of print, and I think I've got about three hard copies of it, and they're probably worth, you know, more than, like, you know, things that I might think are valuable in my life. But these books, only because I was so fixated on this. And to wrap it up, bottom line is, what it ultimately led to is jump cut to, you know, just a few years ago, when I was, you know, fortunate enough to be awarded a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, and given the choice where I wanted it to be, I said, if there's a spot next to Errol Flynn, I'll take it.
Wow.
And there was, and there is. And if you walk down Hollywood Boulevard, you walk over Errol Flynn, and then next step, you walk over me.
That's great. What is it about Errol Flynn that fascinated you so much?
I think what it was is he, to me, he was the epitome of what, if you're going to look in under dictionary under what's a movie star.
Yeah.
That would be, yeah, for my, I would say Errol Flynn. Because he had, he was the whole package. I mean, he was good looking. He was dashing. He was, he had this thing about him. Then when I read his book, it just amplified it all because this guy, the book was called My Wicked, Wicked Ways. Yeah. And was it ever? I mean, this guy, I mean, he lived this incredible life off screen that was much more colorful and interesting than any role he played. And in a way, I think it's because I didn't live a life like that. I mean, I like to think I had a pretty exciting life, but nothing like, I'm no Errol Flynn. But I certainly vicariously lived through kind of that book and what he did and some of the stories in that book. And he was one of the few guys that had, did not have a ghostwriter. I mean, and that was a point that he made even in the book, that he wrote that book. And I just thought, and you can tell by just the way you read it, that it was a guy, these are his own words. This was not somebody trying to glorify his life. Because he really wasn't, it wasn't the kind of book where it's like, oh God, well, how great that I did this. It was more all about some of the really bad stuff, the crazy stuff he did. And he died young, relatively young. I think he was 51 or 52 or something like that. It's as I said, it just throughout my life, as an actor, and also I felt in a way he got cheated as an actor, because I think he got typecast in the days when you would be typecast. And
well,
so
that Robin Hood role, I mean.
Well, sure, Robin Hood, I mean, that kind of said, I mean, then Captain Blood, which he did before that. I mean, and but almost all they died with their boots on. I mean, all the movies he played, they were all big action kind of.
Yeah.
He was either a cowboy or a pirate or a robber in Sherwood Forest or wherever it may be. So very rarely did he get a chance to do dramatic stuff. But when he did, he was really great. I mean, he did the one movie where he got to play John Barrymore. But the movie wasn't even about him. It was about his daughter. Mm. You can just see in that movie, even just a little bit of that movie, or a little bit of that part that he played in the movie, that he had the chops to be a much better dramatic actor. And in a way, I think that's kind of led to his downfall. I mean, he became a terrible alcoholic and all that. And I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that he was phoning it in. I mean, some of the stories, I mean, with him and the Warner Brothers, working at Warner Brothers, and fights he would have with Bette Davis because he was a bigger box office star, and yet he actually envied her for the kinds of roles she got, and she hated him because he was a bigger star than her. So she envied him in one way, and he envied her in the other way, and so never that twain shall meet with that.
Yeah, well, I think it's this myth about Hollywood and this world that we occupy. People have this idea that you're going to go be successful, and then everything's going to be okay.
Oh, yeah. No, in fact, there is a line in the book, which is really amazing. He says, "Here I am. I'm on the top of the world." It was at a time when things couldn't have been better in his career. He was like starring in whatever movie it was that might have been Robin Hood. He had every woman in the world. I mean, there's the phrase, in like Flynn, was because of him, you know. All of it, he says, he says in the book, so here I am. Everything is right in my life. Why am I sitting in my bedroom on the corner of the bed with a barrel of a gun in my mouth?
Wow.
And he literally got to that point.
Right.
He put a barrel of gun in his mouth and thought about killing himself. Mm. And then you start to read about it, and you understand that he just had a lot of demons and this, that, and the other, as do most people, you know, have demons, and he was not exempt. And so all that kind of humanized him for me, though, of course, I never got to meet him. He's still a mythical figure. Maybe in a way that's why I still have such a, you know, admiration for him, because I never got to know him personally. Right. It's all due to, you know, the medium.
It's funny. It never occurred to me, because I never knew any of this or your relationship to him, but it occurs to me now that the character you played in The Assistants is this guy who is, from the outside, very successful. He's a womanizer, and inside, he's a deeply unhappy person.
Right.
And I don't know if you thought about any of that. I certainly didn't.
I mean, now that you mention it, I could say, think to myself, yeah, I probably did channel some of that, in the sense of, like, it probably would have attracted me to the role in a way, you know, because there's that complexity, there's that thing, that dichotomy of things, which are always the great things to play in any role, you know, you always want to play against what's the obvious or be able to have those two sides of a character.
Absolutely. So, John, do you remember how you first came to Adventures of Robin Hood?
I don't know if I can follow that up, but yeah, it was very similar, actually, can I say Joe? Is that all right?
Yeah, please do.
To Joe's exposure to the film, because growing up in D.C., we had black and white television as well. WDCA 20 was what showed all the old films, and you'd watch them on Saturday afternoon. But my first exposure to it was in Looney Tunes, when you saw that, Welcome to Sherwood, that Bugs Bunny cartoon where he swings in.
You're right.
I was like, oh, I remember being a kid, and then when the movie, I think I was just randomly watching movies on a Saturday afternoon, and it came on, and I in black and white, and I was like, wait a minute, that looks so similar to. Yeah. And then it wasn't until later that I saw it at the theaters and with the revival houses and really exploring the technicolor of the film and the vibrancy and everything about it, and I became just as interested in Errol Flynn as well growing up, because I was into the old school, hearing all, because I used to manage a bookstore, so we used to sell all those biographies of the, and so you would sit and read them, and My Wicked Ways is one that people came and bought all the time there in DC, so it was interesting. And I think they did a TV movie based on his life, which wasn't 100% great,
no,
but it was there.
In fact, I knew, I'm trying to think of his name, but I knew the actor who played the part, and he looked good. He really did. I knew the guy, it's based on his name now, because he was also an artist. He actually drew art and stuff, and he was very good. It would have been a difficult movie to capture anyway. But they gave it a shot. But for me, it was all about the book, because that's the kind of book that when you read it, I
have picture to read it.
Him doing it. I picture him doing all this stuff. And some of the stuff he did was just, he killed a guy, he thinks.
Yeah.
He
his car, I think, right?
Well, no, he grew up, the first chapter is called The Tasmanian Devil, because he grew up in Tasmania.
Oh, yeah.
Because Hollywood made it, the Hollywood press machine made it like, Errol Flynn, he's from Ireland, and, he's an Irish actor. And he says, he was not from Ireland. He was born in Tasmania, because his father was an oceanographer or something.
Right.
He had some real crazy job like that. Yeah. So he grew up in Tasmania. But there was this thing where he was like, when he was a young man, they were going through the jungle, and they were looking for coconut fields or something like that, something happened, natives started the whatever, and there was a gunfight ensued. So he's not sure, but he thinks he killed a guy. Shoot and run. And
He went off and sailed from Tasmania to Papua New Guinea or something.
Yeah,
ridiculous.
Well, he was a great sailor. His name of his boat was the Sirocco. Mm. And he was very, he actually then wrote another book, which I have a copy of too. I can't think of the title of it, but it's all about his adventures on his boat.
Yeah,
right. And it's more just that.
Yeah,
but he was a wonderful sailor. He loved that. Spent a lot of time in the all over with that boat.
Yeah, my mom was a massive fan of Errol Flynn, so we would see all his stuff.
Sure.
What you were mentioning, right? Captain Blood. They dive with their boots on. Him and Tyrone Power were the two that my mom absolutely loved.
Exactly.
So,
that's the classic stuff.
Yeah.
My story is going to be real short because it's the same.
Oh, right.
Saturday morning TV, somewhere between the Shirley Temple movies and the Bowery Boy movies the Abbott and Costello movies.
Yeah.
They would play these adventure ones. And here's the thing for me is that I must have watched it a whole bunch as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I'd watched it since.
Really?
Yeah. So for me, it was this weird sensation watching it again of I didn't remember anything and everything was familiar.
Yeah. And the actors. I mean, you had Claude Rains, who was so fantastic. Basil Rathbone. Mm-hmm. I mean, we did an episode of Criminal Minds about 6-7 years ago, and then we hired this young actor who was wonderful, and he was Basil's grandson.
Oh, wow.
Oh, cool.
And his last name was Rathbone. And it was like, I was like more excited to be working with him. You know, he was all excited to work on the show. And I'm saying, oh, forget it, man. I can't match my excitement working with one of the Rathbones,
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, your grandfather was a god to me,
Right. Right. So I did some research, as I always try to do. Mm. And here's the one thing that came up that I thought was so interesting, which is, we did for Holy Grail and for Excalibur, I did a lot of research on King Arthur. And what I discovered doing this is that Robin Hood is very similar in the sense that he is a mythic character of English stories that evolved over time, just like King Arthur did. Yeah. And at each stage, as each new era happened, new ideas were inserted into the Robin Hood myth, just like with King Arthur. So stealing from the rich and robbing from the poor, that came in when ethics, at the same time that Might for Right came in for King Arthur. And the romantic Maid Marian stuff, that wasn't in the original stories. It came in when the Guinevere stuff was coming in for King Arthur, is that each era imposed their ideas onto this character until you get finally to Sir Walter Scott and Ivanhoe. And that's really where it gets solidified with all the King Richard stuff. And and that's sort of the kind of the image of this character we have today, but he's really this amalgam. And by the time we get to, you know, the 1930s, Warner Brothers at that time is really famous for gangster films and Busby Berkeley movies. Like those are the big things that are happening then. And the with the Hays Code coming in, there's all this censorship. They go, oh, maybe we got to lay off some of the gangster pictures. And it's just as Technicolor comes, and they have this idea, we're going to do Robin Hood. And I was shocked to discover who was originally supposed to be cast as Robin Hood.
Yeah. James Cagney.
James Cagney.
Oh, my God. That would have been a whole other movie.
Right?
Right.
Insane.
Well, he's their biggest star at the time.
You dirty rat. Marion.
You Prince John, you.
The idea of Cagney playing this role.
Oh, yeah. He'd have been good in the sword fighting scenes,
though.
Yes, he could move.
Because
he could dance his ass off.
Yeah, absolutely.
Things happen the way they're supposed to happen.
Yeah, he's a diminutive guy, too.
Yeah, no, exactly. Everybody had been standing on, like, soap, you know, little soapboxes.
But he has a big fight with Jack Warner at the time, so he's out.
Oh, wow.
And Errol Flynn had really come from nowhere. Hmm. My understanding is that he just had essentially a nobody actor and had a screen test for Captain Blood.
All he had really going for him was his good looks and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And when he came to Hollywood, he was kind of like banging around and did some small stuff. But, you know, eventually he got one thing led to another. And I think he had, like I said, he had that kind of dashing leading man look already.
Mm-hmm.
And what I loved about him is he had that personality. That's the other thing about actors and actresses from that era. Unlike today where you can, you know, flick on any, whether a podcast, a TV show, an interview show, you know who the stars are from television and film. You see the personal side of them. Mm-hmm. In other words, you have a million opportunities to see what they are as people beyond their work. Back then, no. So, I mean, Errol Flynn, to me, he only existed on film.
Right.
Like, what is Errol Flynn like off camera? Who knew? Yeah. And when there was rare times when I was able to catch footage of like old clips of like especially when they came out with those kind of collections later of, you know, Hollywood is the great years of Hollywood, and they would show little clips of, you know, and here's Errol Flynn, you know, showing up at some charity thing, and then he says a couple words off camera, and you're like, wow, he actually, well, look at him, he's wearing regular clothes, and you know what I mean, and that's kind of that. I think that helps perpetuate the myth of these kinds of actors, because you only knew them as these kind of supernatural beings that they were on film, you know.
Well, now we're in the opposite world where every little
detail
is horrible.
Well, now with the internet and this, that, and also to become a star, you become a huge star just by being who you are. I mean, it's like nuts. You know, it's personalities are driving it as a, so whatever. It's a different time, different thing.
Yeah, so originally William Keighley is the director, and he directs essentially half the film, it seems like. And then the movie's going way over budget, it's over schedule, and they bring in Michael Curtiz, who's, you know, one of our great, and I think underrated directors.
Absolutely.
He's one that we don't talk about in that list of John Ford and Howard Hawks.
Oh, I agree with you.
He's so good.
And as I recall, too, Curtiz used to have like a deal with Flynn, too, that if he would just stay sober until they wrapped, he would go drink with him afterwards, because Flynn hated to drink alone.
Oh, there we go.
You know, so it was like, okay. And he says that's what kind of worked, because they'd already worked together, you know, before, and so they knew each other's
game. If you have a proclivity for depression, the last thing you want to do is drink alone.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
You want someone around so you don't put the barrel in your mouth by yourself. You know?
Right.
It's good advice.
always good advice.
Should we get into the movie?
Yeah,
sure.
So we open on this parchment in our classic 1938 romantic adventure style. And we immediately have this announcement that King Richard was captured during the Crusades. And we meet our bad guys right away. King John and Guy of Gisborne. Claude Rains, and Basil Rathbone.
Yeah, I mean, the best. Probably the two of the greatest villains in the history of film.
Yeah.
And what's nice is they counterbalanced each other. I mean, one guy's kind of this little kind of Weasley kind of guy, and Rathbone was this kind of distinguished, I mean, I remember Errol in Wicked Wicked Ways, he talks about the sword fights in that movie, and he says it was really tough on him because, you know, Errol would be had been coming off a binge the night before, and now he's got a sword fight. And of course, he would just learn as much as he needed to learn. And he says Rathbone really took it seriously, and Rathbone really was good at it.
That's
otherwise, he was one of those guys that studied it.
Yeah.
And so he says, in those fights, he'd be like, Errol Flynn was just like, I just want to get through this. You know, this guy could kill me if I let him go, you know.
Boy, that's dead. The last thing I want to be sword fighting with exactly. is a drunk guy just trying to get through it.
Exactly.
that's brutal.
But yeah, but I thought that they were so great, Claude Rains and Rathbone together, because they were just perfect kind of foils.
For well, of course, because I hadn't seen it in forever. Mm. Of course, I remembered Basil Rathbone. I had forgotten that it was Claude Rains.
Oh, yeah.
And I, you know, having watched him in Casablanca and Lawrence of Arabia, we did Mr. Smith Goes to Washington for the show, and like, what an amazing actor he is.
Oh, great actor.
Just unbelievable range.
Absolutely.
And when you cast two actors like that, you want them not to play the same type of villain, right? And you get, he's more effeminate, Claude Rains.
Exactly.
He's really, oh, let him talk. I want to hear what he has to say.
Oh, yeah.
And Rathbone is more like, even when he challenges him later in the film, he's like all up on Claude Rains, which you're like so surprised by, but it's the power of Rathbone. You know, he does Sherlock Holmes later in life. Like, he's just one of these guys that just has that magnetic personality.
It was almost like good cop, bad cop.
Absolutely. So we go into there's a montage of the Normans going off after the Saxons to raise taxes, which is fairly brutal.
Yeah.
And then we get the arrival of Robin Hood and Will Scarlet. And I just found out that David Niven was supposed to play Will Scarlet.
Oh, wow.
Now, then he'd have been a good job.
He'd have done
a good job. And they were all close. They were all members of the same club. I think they were called the Olympiads. They all hung out at what was called Mulholland House, which was Errol's house.
Oh. Oh,
and it was David Niven, it was Errol Flynn, it was John Barrymore, W.C. Fields, all these.
Wow.
They were all drinkers.
Can you imagine being at that party?
Just hanging out.
Oh, man, I dream about it. Yeah. I dream. I'm born in the wrong time, definitely. I really see myself with those guys. But I can see Niven playing Will Scarlet.
Yeah, not that there's anything wrong with the guy.
The guy was great.
He's great.
Mm-hmm. Everybody's great. No, no bad actors in that movie.
Yeah.
No.
We see that this character, Much, who's from the old ballads of Robin Hood, has poached a deer, and Robin shoots that arrow out of Guy's hand and just is right up on him.
Right.
This is the thing about Robin Hood throughout this movie. He's like, dude, what are you doing? Like, what's your plan here?
Yeah, this is before Kevlar. You know, he's taking a chance.
He confronts Basil. He says, "Oh, he shot him. He shot the deer for me. He's my servant,"
right.
and saves the guy's life.
And he does it with a smile on his face too. Yeah. That's what I love
throughout
about
the whole
Flynn. Always just like ha ha ha, showing all those million-dollar teeth, and it's like, unbelievable.
But this is what works if you look at the history of Robin, because he's the son of a lord. He feels that like the people are his crew, but he is a rich. So he's legitimately white privilege back in 1938, just storming into areas completely unafraid, not having an issue with it, and I love that because you go along with him because you're right. His looks and his teeth and everything about it, you're just like, I would follow this guy everywhere. So when Much says to him, you know, I pledge my sword to you, I'll follow. You
it was like it. Sinatra.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Sinatra
walks
pack,
in the room, right.
You know. Well, there's some people that are just like this, that have this kind of confidence.
Yeah.
Maybe a little overconfidence for Robin a few times.
Yeah, yeah.
We go back to King John. They're having a big feast. We're getting some guys swearing loyalty, and we get the sense that we're not such a big fan of Richard. You know,
right?
Yeah. And we meet Maid Marian for the first time, Olivia de Havilland.
Oh yeah.
Did you get to meet her?
No, I never got to meet Olivia de Havilland.
Did you recently pass her?
Last year.
Oh, last year?
At 101 years old.
That's amazing.
What's funny, my mom passed this year at 101 years old.
Oh, wow.
So there's that connection. But she was just, what was great about her too is that she wasn't, she's this beautiful woman, but yet not in a classic sense.
No,
she has that kind of vulnerability. She was not like a, this va-va-voom, kind of like a, you know, Rita Hayworth type, you know. And she was perfect as Maid Marian.
She's amazing and had a long, multiple movies with Errol Flynn.
Right.
She was in Captain Blood with him, and that became just a thing going on. Guy tells Sir John about Robin, and we're like, okay, we've got to arrest this guy and bring him in. There's also, you know, it seems as if King John is sort of pushing Maid Marian onto Guy. Mm-hmm. She doesn't seem that into it.
Yeah, no, Guy, I think he was a asexual anyway. I get the feeling, you know.
But also, we see her be like violently against the Saxons, like right? She's,
absolutely.
Like she's, I'm a Norman. That's Saxon swine. Like she, you. That's something. That's something you don't see a lot of the Maid Marians that they do in the modern interpretation. Certainly not in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Right? No, you're right.
This is a harder.
They were
Marian
smart
than
enough.
Seen.
I mean, I think you know. You think about it. Yeah. This is a time when you know you got like Scott Fitzgerald and guys like they were writing scripts back then.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Right.
They had guys that were actually bringing a little more to these screenplays than meet the eye.
Yeah.
You know, a little more layered. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And now we get another great Robin Hood entrance.
Right.
This is my favorite. This of his three big entrances, this is my favorite.
Open the door.
Barreling through that door with the big deer on his shoulders.
Oh, my God. It just flips it off his shoulders, and it was like, yeah, unbelievable.
With that great, great score, it's... Eric Korngold.
Right.
I mean, it's so, this is a hero has walked in. And he has once again walked into a situation where you're like, how are you going to get out of this, Robin?
Oh, yeah.
What's your plan here?
Yeah, he'll find a way.
He always does.
Bring Sir Robin food at once, do you hear? Such impudence must support a mighty appetite.
True enough, Your Highness. We Saxons have little to fatten on by the time your tax gatherers are through.
So you think you're overtaxed, eh?
Overtaxed, overworked, and paid off with a knife, a club, or a rope.
Why, you speak treason.
Fluently.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Come on.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's what I mean. That's what also the other thing about the movie that I love is the times where it gets... When they push the envelope of corny.
Yeah.
Or they push the envelope of being like over the top. It's like this when the scene comes later when he's doing the you know, they come up with this bright idea. Yes, of course he's going to enter the archery contest.
Right, right.
So, but for him to actually, he gives that look like when he, you know, realizes that they're right. onto him. It's like, oh, please, of course you know they're onto you. You know what I mean? But those moments are priceless. It's almost like, almost melodramatic, mm-hmm. but it helps though. But, we're not doing 60s realism here. This
right,
is 30s, man. This is all balls out. Let's do it.
Well, this is it's like a superhero movie today. It's
yeah.
like this is we're not
right.
we're not trying to have realism.
Exactly.
This is a hero. This is a swashbuckler.
Mm.
And just so you say, similar moment here. He's sitting eating his dinner.
Right.
And he looks out and sees, oh, they're closing that gate and the
right.
guards are moving around here.
Right.
He knows it's coming.
Yeah.
Right.
And yet he still keeps talking.
Yeah.
And he essentially says right to the king's face,
I'll organize revolt. Exact a death for a death. And I'll never rest until every Saxon in the Shire can stand up, free men, and strike a blow for Richard and England.
Have you finished?
I'm only just beginning. From this night on, I use every means in my power to fight you.
Yeah.
And
this scene is really effective at laying the relationship that he's going to have with Guy, with Prince John, and with Maid Marian, because even when because Maid Marian kind of snaps at him and he snaps back,
mm-hmm.
and Prince John points that out and goes, oh, listen, Guy can't say a word to her, but this guy comes in and swaggers, and then he kicks the Lord out and sits down and starts eating heartily. And you see this relationship that he's developing with everything that's going to carry through the whole movie, and it's established right there without needing to say exposition. It's
right.
just all in
exactly
interaction.
Right.
And
yep.
that's a brilliant way to do it.
Yeah, that's right. I give Curtiz a lot of credit for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Curtiz did. My understanding is that Michael Wheeler. Wait, what's his name? Michael Wheeler.
Sure, let's say Wheeler. I'm sure you can edit it in post.
Okay, okay. So we'll fix it in post. That he shot all the exteriors, which are shot like Sherwood Forest, is all upshot in Chico, like 400 miles north of Los Angeles. It's
oh, wow.
bizarre that they went all the way up to Chico.
Yeah, I'd heard too that they actually shot. They did some pickup shots in Griffith Park.
Oh, they did, and they did also out in Pasadena, at what used to be Busch Gardens, which is not there anymore, but that's where they shot the some of the exteriors were gone with the wind and other stuff there.
Mm-hmm.
But the majority of Sherwood Forest is in Chico, and so that was the first director. But by the time we get onto the interior shots and the set stuff, now we got Michael Curtiz.
Yeah,
and you can tell by the camera angles and the use of shadows and the lighting is just we get to kind of a new level here.
Yeah.
So the trap is ready, and Robin Hood is going to fight his way out of the castle against unbelievable odds.
Of course he is.
And it's funny, I love the way Errol Flynn fights. It is just aggressive and just charging at people and fearless.
Yeah, and uses the environment, you know, jumping on drapes and things and up the stairs, down the wall.
And then he does the great run to the gate and says, you got to stop him. You got to, you know, something's coming. And he runs outside as they close the gate. That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. Gets back to Sherwood Forest and does the, okay, pass the word for everyone who's ever been trotted on. Let's get the guys together. We're going to have a revolt.
Right.
Back in Sherwood Forest, Robin Hood wants to walk across this log.
Yep.
There's this other guy on the other side of the log.
Oh, yeah.
Little John, Alan Hale Sr.
Right.
Who looks like the skipper?
Who looks like you definitely see the skipper.
Yeah. It's fantastic. Yeah.
And of course, I knew the skipper a lot better than I knew Alan Hale Sr.
Sure, sure.
From when I grew up.
Yeah.
Skipper used to head a restaurant in La Cienega.
Oh, really?
I first moved out here, there was this, I can't think of the name of it, it was a seafood restaurant.
Of course.
It was right on La Cienega. Right. Yeah. It was right off La Cienega and Melrose. And I think it might have been, I think it was called Mikhail. No, I forget the name of it. But he's there. He would be there. He'd be standing up front sometimes, you know. Oh, my God. It's, you know.
Yeah, wow. That's crazy.
And for you kids listening, we're talking about Gilligan's Island. And Skipper was Alan Hale Jr., who is the son of Alan Hale, who plays Little John in the movie.
Yeah. Here's, again, things that I didn't know.
Yeah.
So there have been a bunch of Robin Hood movies in Hollywood previous to this. And the biggest, most important one is Douglas Fairbanks.
Right.
And the person who played Little John in the Douglas Fairbanks movie is Alan Hale Sr.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah. And he played Little John later in the 50s in some other Robin Hood movie.
Wow.
So he played, as the only person I know in history.
He made a career out of playing Little John.
He played Little John. And he's on this log.
I can do it better. I can do it better. Give me another chance. I can do it better.
And Robin comes up on the log. We get some quarterstaffs, and we have a quarterstaff battle.
It's just scary. That battle is way quicker than I remember it, and it looks like Errol is like barely hanging on.
It really does.
And not getting his hands crushed.
Yeah, he talks a lot about all the different. And another time in the book, where he talks about when he was doing Charge of the Light Brigade, where literally, you know, these guys are really, you know, back. Those were the days when they were tripping horses and stuff.
Right.
And he said he witnessed the thing where they tripped the horse, and the stunt rider, they were trained to do this. They would throw the saber so that you get rid of it.
Right.
He says it was this freak thing where he throws the saber. The horse gets tripped. The stunt guy flies off the horse, and the saber lands on its hilt.
Oh, wow.
With the blade up, and this guy impales himself.
Oh, my God.
And was killed. Wow. See, this is the kind of stuff that was going on in Hollywood. So, I mean, this is a little departure from Robin Hood, but it shows you the kinds of things, you know. So, whacking a stick on a log was nothing, you know. I mean, it was like.
Well, but it does. I mean, in Robin Hood, if you look at some of the stunts, you know, some of these guys jumping out of a high tree onto a guy with a horse.
Right.
So, you think about the way a stunt is done today, where they've got computers out and math, and they're like, okay, this is going to move at 17 miles an hour at this thing. And this is like, I'm just going to jump on that dude's horse.
Right. Get that guy. Like you, the gymnast, get him jumping.
We're going to just hope for the best.
Or later falling down those concrete stairs, like that's no
and,
joke,
and you can see that Flynn did a lot of stunts. I mean, there was no cheating there. You saw that he was in the water. He was whacking that guy. I mean,
absolutely. And it's funny, so this fight scene to me is so sets up what Robin Hood is about, which is we're having fun,
right? Mm-hmm.
There's no sense that these guys want to hurt each other.
No,
this is manly fun, right. You know. And Little John wins, knocks Robin into the water, and immediately it's like, "Oh, you're Robin Hood!
You've
I want to join
me. I love you for it."
That's great stuff.
Yeah,
that's great stuff.
And he pulls off those yellow tights really well.
Yeah,
right. Those are not easy to do.
No.
Yeah, maybe we should take a moment to honor the tights.
Yeah, I mean, the tights are amazing.
Hey, look, Mel Brooks wound up making a whole homage to
it,
right?
That's true.
Yeah,
Robin
those
Hood,
are,
that's right.
Those are some serious green tights.
Yeah, but again, not everybody could pull that off.
Right.
You know, he did.
He's got nice legs.
He's got nice legs,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. We see much more of his legs than Olivia de Havilland's in the film.
Exactly.
That's the way it was back then.
Well, Much is going out talking to the peasants saying, hey, come on, meet Robin Hood. At the same time, we're having this proclamation, we're going to go kill Robin Hood, which is a great juxtaposition. And now we have in Sherwood Forest, and Robin Hood gives his big speech. And this is like, again, this is the classic hero stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Now, this forest is wide. It can shelter and clothe and feed a band of good determined men, good swordsmen, good archers, good fighters. Men, if you're willing to fight for our people, I want you. Are you with me? Aye! Then kneel and swear this oath. That you, the free men of this forest, swear to despoil the rich, only to give to the poor, to shelter the old and the helpless, to protect all women, rich or poor, Norman or Saxon, swear to fight for a free England, to protect her loyally until the return of our king and sovereign, Richard the Lionheart,
and swear to fight to the death against our oppressors.
And this is where we hear this philosophy of we're going to take from the rich and give to the poor.
Yeah.
A very controversial philosophy throughout history.
Yes.
You know, they swear this oath. And now we start to see them rescuing people.
Yeah.
There's these people being, you know, the Saxons are being tortured. They're, where's Robin Hood? They're raising taxes. And out of nowhere.
Yeah. There's a lot of that going on.
Yeah. And it's funny. So this is a new way of shooting people with arrows. Mm. There's a guy whose name is Howard Hill. He's a world-class archer. He's the archery guy on this movie. And previous, the way they usually would do arrows, they stick an arrow in someone's chest and they'd have a string attached to it. They pull it out and they'd show it in reverse. Mm. And that's the simplest, easy way to do it. These guys are really getting shot with arrows.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. Is that they're wearing like kind of a padded shirt. Yeah.
Sometimes you even can see it. You can see the pad.
Yeah.
Instances.
And then it's balsa wood, and then it's a steel plate, and then it's a pad.
Yeah.
But that's just that's just Howard Hill shooting a dude with an arrow.
I love it.
That's the way to do it.
That's also one of the things that's incredible about the movie is that he is killing people. Like, Robin is absolutely killing people with his arrow and everything like that, but it's played with such fun that you never feel the deaths of these people at all.
No.
Even when they show them with their sword, with their shields on top of them and they're honoring them in that scene later, you don't necessarily feel the deaths because he's such a swashbuckling guy. You don't feel the pain of it.
Well, this is the difference in style of movie. Is that, you know, we just did Iron Man a little while ago.
Yeah.
He kills a whole bunch of people.
Yes, he does.
Or even go back to Indiana Jones. The one scene everybody remembers is when the guy's coming at him with the sword and he just pulls the gun and shoots him.
Right.
And it's like that's like the classic scene, but you don't realize the guy dies. kill him. But yet it was reminiscent of those kind of Robin Hood.
Yeah. Movies.
But this is the thing that's interesting about movies is there's some movies where you're going to feel that death. And there's some movies where you're not,
right.
You know, and that's the design is that, and for whatever reason, we as an audience member get it. We go like, oh, this one, that's fine.
Yeah.
And then there's other movies. We just did The Dirty Dozen.
Yeah.
And in The Dirty Dozen, in the end, you do feel all those deaths.
Sometimes the common denominator or what sets it apart is actually blood.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's a bloodless killing, you kind of buy it. It's like the old movies where you're just like, oh, you know, you fall over. Right. Oh, you can do all the contortions you want, but as long as you don't see a trickle of anything.
Yeah.
And then it's like, oh, then the kid's like, oh, he really is dead.
Yeah, and it's also sort of the reaction shots and the and music and how we're, you know, are we moving on right away? Mm-hmm. Oh, they're dead. And here goes another one.
As long as the music's going.
And it's all good. And now we get to meet our next big character. There's this friar who's doing a little fishing.
Give me back my mutton joint.
Robber thief! Give me back my mutton joint.
Oh! I still remember that line.
Eugene Paulette.
Right.
Yeah. And we saw him in, because we did Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and his voice is just one of the great voices of all time.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. My Fat Tony on The Simpsons is, there's a little of Gene in there.
A little bit of that, you know. I get it more down in here, you know, but
but it's that guys like that.
Well, this is, you know, coming from that era when there's radio, I think voice casting was a bigger thing
without
than it is
question.
Now. Yeah, that you'd have these voices, which is interesting because Eugene Paulette started in silent films. He's in D.W. Griffin's Intolerance.
Really?
Wow.
And he played Aramis with Douglas Fairbanks in The Three Musketeers.
No kidding.
As a young guy, he's like a sword fighting hero.
I can see it.
Yeah.
Because he actually handled the sword pretty well in the
really
scene
well,
with Daryl.
Right. Really well. And the fight is very similar tonally to the Little John fight.
Mm-hmm.
We're having fun.
Yeah.
We're not trying to kill
each
other.
No, of course not.
No, we're having a good time. Will arrives to tell us that, Guy of Gisborne is coming. He's got the tax money. He's got Lady Marian with him. And we're going to set up a big ambush. I love this ambush.
Mm.
It is great.
Oh, it's just fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, and this is complicated. We got a lot of dudes on a lot of vines,
ropes,
and people in trees.
Carriages, and
One other just great piece of trivia that I found out. So Olivia de Havilland's horse, that's Trigger.
Really?
That's the horse that became Trigger.
How great is that?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's just amazing to me.
That's awesome, yeah.
Yeah. And so this ambush happens, and they're swinging in on these ropes and dropping out of trees. And you know what the thing that it made me think of was? Ewoks.
Oh, from Jedi.
Totally the Ewok attack in Jedi. And I really wonder if George Lucas, I'm sure George Lucas had to love this movie.
I would think he's inspired. He'd have to be. And just same thing, like I said, with, again, even going back to like movies like Indiana Jones and stuff. They had to be inspired by these kinds of movies.
Yeah, had to be.
That's where you get it from.
Yeah. And we have our third great Errol Flynn Robin Hood entrance. Swinging up on that vine.
Sherwood, my lady.
Oh, yeah, that was it. That's the poster almost. That's the one.
It's the best.
Yeah.
It's the best. Man, this guy's just fearless. He's completely fearless. Either we head off to go to camp. Marion does not like him.
No.
She's not a fan.
They're playing very hard to get at that point.
Extremely.
Yeah.
But as opposed to Much and Bess, Marion's lady in waiting, hit it off right away.
Two great Shakespearean characters. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like the nurse and the Romeo and Juliet. I mean, you get these two great characters with those two. Yeah. Little comic relief, you know.
And he's like, isn't he like in Macbeth? There's that guard of the gatekeeper. Yeah, it's kind of like that. That's a great point you bring up, Joe.
Yeah. We get back to camp. We're sharing out the goods. We're having a big party. Robin's talking to Marion. She's having none of it.
Right.
She won't eat. She's just like, you're an evil person.
Right.
You speak of loyalty.
Yes, why not?
I suppose you and your band of cutthroats intend to send this treasure to Richard. You wouldn't dream of keeping it yourselves.
And I think the turn happens when she thinks they're stealing all the gold for themselves.
Right.
And the gold is supposed to go to Richard, which John really wasn't sending it to Richard. He was going to just keep it. And Robin stands up and says,
friends, what shall we do with this treasure? Divide it amongst ourselves?
Hold it for Richard!
It belongs to the king!
That's where the turn starts. You see the turn start with Marion.
And then when he says, here, let me show you. And then she goes, she doesn't want to go. And he goes, they're afraid. Then she goes, and that's when the movie gets serious. And he takes her and shows the people that have been tortured and stolen from. And
hardly an inspiring sight for such pretty eyes as yours, I'm sure. But these poor devils have all had their homes burned. Their families beaten and starved to death by your tax gatherers.
Bless you, Robin. We'll never forget you.
Oh, well, thanks, Master. May we be worthy, Robin.
You are, Mother, you are.
And that's another great moment because it'll take you from all that frivolity and this and excitement, and all of a sudden it gets somber and serious, and it's like, oh, okay, you know.
Yeah. Well, and this is why it's so poignant, as you pointed out, John, that Marion calls him a Saxon dog at the beginning. Yeah. She is bought into the paradigm of Normans and Saxons that she's been taught.
Right.
And this is the moment where she goes, oh, shit.
Right.
Yeah. I was wrong.
Yeah, and this also speaks to Joe's earlier point that he can do dramatic scenes when he was given the chance. In this scene, when he's walking Marion through this, or Olivia de Havilland, you see Errol's real like statesmanship and leadership of these people coming through.
When
feeling their
woman
pain.
Goes up, oh, thank you, Robin, little old lady. Oh my God!
And there's this moment where she says, "Well, what's your reward?" And that's a great Errol Flynn acting moment because his response is, "Oh, you really don't understand.
Yeah,
right.
How have you not understood?
Mm-hmm.
This is and that's it. Marion has turned the corner
because he even says then, I think I do. he finally does get it.
So we release them all. Mm-hmm. Guy and the sheriff. We haven't talked about the sheriff of Nottingham. We have to talk about him a little
bit. So great.
Yeah.
Great, great comic relief. And very different from what you would expect. Constantly like going, as soon as there's action, he's like fading into the background.
Yeah. It's like that Simpsons where Homer's fading into the bushes. That's basically what he's doing, right?
Yeah, it's great.
I'll be over here.
Yeah.
My favorite is when he puts his cape over Prince John's, like, if only I could reach Robin. And he's like, he's totally like 2 feet away.
Yeah.
It's brilliant.
It's great. It's great. So they're back with King John and they've been dressed in sort of rags and stuff and complaining about Robin. And it's the Sheriff of Nottingham that comes up with a plan. Right. We're going to have an archery contest.
Right. Yep.
And he even kind of is noticing that, I think there's a little thing with Marion. That's good. So we'll have her present the golden arrow.
The golden arrow. Right.
Yeah. And this is, of course, one of the classic stories out of the ballads of Robin Hood. We're gonna have our big archery contest, and as we're sitting there and we have big fanfare, lots, huge crowds. This is also shot by Michael Curtiz. You could see Marion start to realize, oh shit, this is a trap.
Yeah.
And in come Robin. It's really not much of a disguise.
No, I was just going to say, they all come in. He's the only good-looking guy in the group. Even his hood looks nice, you know, and they all come walking in as a group. And it's like, it was like a posse coming in. It was like...
Well, all you did was not wear green.
Yeah, I mean,
basically, he doesn't have a fake beard. There's nothing.
No, 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 no.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. He's giving those furtive glances. Like, I wonder if they're on to me, you know.
Yeah. He's a good-looking tinker. That's for sure.
He sure is.
That's the tinker, right.
We have our archery contest. Of course, we come down to the final two archers, and we get the moment, which is, I'd say, one of the top classic Robin Hood moments, to split the arrow.
He split the arrow.
Yeah, it's great. And I remember watching a whole Mythbusters where they said, is it possible to split an arrow? And I honestly, at this moment, cannot remember if they were able to do it.
Yeah, we're going to have to do it. My assistant, Dan, has the show Hollywood Weapons that he produced. Where this is exactly what we do. We take things like that and see. Dan, make a note. We got to do Robin Hood. We have to split the arrow. Because we found out, like, you could... The Clint Eastwood movie where the guy gets hung and he shoots the gun and
Kids.
We did it on the last season's episode, one of the episodes, and it can be done. It was done. Wow. The only thing is the bullet was, the guy was, our star of the show was a sniper, was a Green Beret sniper. So he's so good that the bullet went through the rope. And the rope still held because it made it perfect.
Did you have to get a higher caliber weapon?
We used the exactly caliber they used in the movie. It was like a Sharps rifle, and we had to duplicate it exactly. So, but what it showed is it is possible. So splitting the arrow, of course, is possible. You just got to hit the arrow.
Yeah.
But, guy, you know, you shoot enough time to do it under one first shot. That's where you're going, taking a little theatrical license.
Well, it's Robin Hood.
It's Robin Hood. Right. The Tinker.
The Tinker. Do these things.
By the way, that's his hubris, isn't it? Like, Robin's like, oh, sure, I'm going to go get this golden arrow. And he knows it's a trap. That's why he's disguised. That's why
this is what I'm saying about him. He does not have a good plan.
No,
he keeps walking.
He doesn't think it out too well. No.
Well, and he's put, I mean, like, if we were to take this realistically for a moment, which we shouldn't.
Right.
But he's putting all of his men in danger.
I can see Will Scarlet going, oh, God.
All right. Jesus. Oh, all right. Come on, Robin.
Okay, is that what we're going to do? Okay.
Yeah, you remember we actually have a rebellion here.
I'll play the mandolin in the back. Hope for the best.
So, of course, he wins the contest. He goes up, Marion presents him with the arrow, and everybody knows this is Robin Hood. I fooled him.
Yeah.
And again, we have the guards are closing in, very similar to that scene at the feast. Robin's kind of looking around, and the merry men are looking around. And a guy comes up and slaps his face. And I love that the sheriff goes, oh, that looks like a good idea. And gets kicked right in the chest.
Yeah. Right. Bang.
And then Robin tries to escape. He makes a good attempt.
Yeah. He visits the little college tribe.
I'm going to say that King John's guards are not that good. They need some more training. But they drag him off a horse and they got him. And Robin Hood's been captured.
Yeah.
He goes on trial.
Right.
That's it. We're going to have to execute you. And this is where Marion becomes a hero.
Yeah.
Yeah. She finds out from Bess where the merry men hang out. By the way, I have a problem with Marion and the merry men. I keep, like, my mouth doesn't handle it very well. And she goes off to this inn. And, you know, it says you've got to help Robin Hood. Of course, they don't trust her at first. Friar Tuck talks to her.
You're a good daughter of the church. You swear by Our Lady that you want to help Robin.
I swear, good father.
Have you thought of a way?
Yes.
Can you get us into the castle?
That would do no good. He's too heavily guarded. But I thought of another way. Listen to me.
Marion, unlike Robin Hood, has a plan.
Yes, exactly. Well, it's, you know, brains and brawn. Apparently. They were good. They got their kid would have been great.
I think we have a movie here.
Yeah, there we go.
The Son of Robin Hood.
Yes.
So it's the day of the hanging. Robin is getting brought out. And this is Michael Curtiz. One of the things that you really see with him is these interesting camera angles, low angles, Dutch angles, things with the objects in the foreground. And you really see it in this sequence. Robin's looking around and he sees the merry men and he goes, okay, we're gonna be all right.
Yeah.
And there's some great stunts in this sequence, in this action sequence. I love, and it's a stuntman, but Robin Hood with his hands tied behind his back, jumping on that horse. Mm-hmm. That is cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the great one is him. They're at the portcullis, the big, huge gate, and Robin cuts the rope on the gate. And not only does he get pulled up by the rope, but he's actually climbing the rope doing it.
Oh, yeah.
That is great.
Yeah, and I think it's going down. He's going up. It's fantastic.
Yeah, and that's also Stuntman. And that is a reference, if you watch, which I have never seen, but I've seen clips of it, the original Fairbanks one. He does a very similar stunt.
Yeah.
So they're referencing that.
And what's great about the stunts in the film is that they do the right mix of choreography and what looks like impromptu, right? It's clean but messy at the same time, like it would be normally if you were to see it in real life. So as fantastical as the film is, it still brings an element of realism in certain moments, and certainly in the stunt moments it does.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's this thing. I mean, when you drop out of a tree
yeah.
onto a dude on a horse,
yeah.
there's no way to control what's going to happen.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, you don't, and I feel bad for the horse.
Yeah.
Because the horse, well, yeah, the horse is just standing there. The dude knew right. that this someone was coming.
This before, you know, the ASPCA.
No, yeah, no animals yeah, were harmed.
No. Every animal was harmed in this
movie. Yeah. And naturally, since Robin has just barely escaped from his previous bad plan, what does he do? He goes back to the castle, climbs up the wall of the castle to talk to Marianne.
Well, sure.
This scene is great. It's a lovely scene.
It's a very romantic scene.
It's the Romeo and Juliet scene.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And she's denying being in love with him. He goes, okay, well, I'll just have to jump out the window then.
No. Yeah.
Now, let me see. There's a fat old captain of the guard down there with bow legs. Mm. If I drop on him, that'll bend him out worse. Ah, there's an archer. No, he's too thin. I might miss him altogether.
Robin.
The very thing. 5 men-at-arms talk in a group. They'll break the fall beautifully. Goodbye, my lady.
Robin.
Yes?
Please.
Then you do love me, don't you? Don't you?
You know I do.
Well, that's different.
It's great.
And you do love me then.
Yeah.
Do you remember having a crush on Olive when you saw it the first? Like, was that something that you remember developing, or was it she just one of those, like, you couldn't even have a crush on her because she's so regal, so just incredibly beautiful?
I think
beautiful.
It was more that.
Yeah.
She was too much. She was too good for me. I mean, I'm a young guy from Cicero. What the hell chance have I got? You know? No, I worship that from afar. Yeah. You know?
All right. The music, again, in this scene is great. And the composer's Eric Korngold, and I have to tell a story that I read about him. There's actually two stories like this that have to do with this film.
And he did the Captain Blood too.
He did Captain Blood too.
Yeah.
And he was an Austrian, prodigy composer. Wrote operas, very famous. And they fly him from Austria to the United States and say, "We want you to do Robin Hood." He watches the movie. He says, "I can't do this. This is all action. It's not what I do. I can't. It would be terrible. I would hate myself. I can't do it." And he goes back to his hotel or whatever, and the head of music for Warner Brothers goes to the hotel to try to convince him, please, no, you have to do this. The same hour this guy shows up is when Hitler and the Nazis take over Austria.
Wow.
And suddenly his son and his wife, I think, and some of his family, who are Jewish, are trapped in Austria.
Oh.
And
what a lucky break.
I know. And Warner Brothers gets him out.
Wow.
And he does Robin Hood.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Meant to be.
Yeah. Wow. And I mean,
it's brilliant. I mean, I have the soundtrack just for that.
The score is amazing.
It's just amazing.
And what's really crazy is, so Michael Curtiz grew up in Austria-Hungary when there was Austria-Hungary, was in the First World War as a filmmaker. He made 64 films in Europe before coming to the U.S.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Came to the U.S. and made 101 films in the U.S.
Wow.
Yeah, well, many of whom which have been lost. When he first got here in the 20s and in the silent era, he just never said no. So he made 6 films a year.
Yeah, back then they did. The actors did too, you know.
And again, he's also Jewish, and when World War II starts, Warner Brothers gets some of his family out.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah. So that's, you know, whatever you say about the studio system and whatever might be said about Jack Warner.
Oh, no. Well, that's true. Well, the thing is, Flynn talked about, he said, it's funny, I'm a member of Lakeside Country Club here, mm-hmm. and back then it was restricted.
Yeah.
You know, and Flynn talks about it in the book. He says Warner, there was an animosity between Warner and Errol, mainly partly for the fact that Errol was a member of that country club, because it's right across the street from Warner Brothers.
Right.
And one of the things I pride of being a member there is there's the photos of all the members up in the bar, in the men's bar, and Errol Flynn's up there.
Yeah.
You know, and I've already kind of hinted that I would kind of like mine to put next to his if possible. We can kind of move that guy's been dead a long time, the guy next to him. Let's put me in up in there. But the thing is, but what was funny is Errol at the time didn't even, you know, he didn't care. He didn't know. He didn't know it was restricted. I mean, it was like he didn't give a shit about it.
Well, how would you know? I mean, unless you know, my family would know.
Yeah.
But how would Errol Flynn
know? Yeah, no, he wouldn't have known. But you're right. The moguls, is as much as you heard of the bad aspect of them, there was that great. To me, they made Hollywood. They were a
no question
big
about
part
it.
About it. Yeah,
absolutely. So we end up at this inn. And we see these characters talking, and we don't know who these people are. They're sort of wearing cloaks. Right. And they're having some conversation. And they kind of are finding out about the issues between Normans and Saxons. And they've been hearing this name of Robin Hood. And who walks in but the bishop, who's someone we haven't talked about, but another one of the King John supporters.
Right.
And he starts complaining about Robin Hood. And then the bishop overhears them saying the word sire.
Right.
Mm. Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Who is this guy?
Yeah.
Because we know that King Richard has been gone, and we know that he was captured by Austria. And who is this guy?
Yeah.
And so the bishop goes back to King John and says, King Richard is in town. And it's, I keep saying King John. It's Prince John.
Yeah, Prince John.
Prince John.
Because Prince John would like to be King John.
Yeah, he wants to move up. Yeah. He wants to get up the food chain as quickly as possible.
Yeah. And so he says, well, let's get rid of Richard. He doesn't have an army with him.
Right.
Let's kill him. And there's this knight who looks very dastardly.
Yes.
I think his name is.
Dickon.
Yeah. Dickon. And he'll do it. And if he does it, he can have Robin of Locksley's lands and titles.
Right. Right.
And
well, throw in this motivation aspect, because the King Richard had taken his lands and Dickon's all his stuff because
he was
disgraceful in his service as a knight. Right. So he took it away from him. So this was his way of like reestablishing himself.
And right.
There's nothing like creating an assassin that has an extra motivation.
Yeah. That's how I create all my assassins.
Exactly. Yeah. And I love the fact that Dickon, he really is. He looks like a formidable guy.
Yeah.
You know, he looks a formidable. And what I love is that Robin sends Munch, or, you know, the littlest guy, the guy that's kind of like the, you know, rather than sending, it's like, you know, it's not like Battle of
Little
the Titans. He's sending this little guy over there who's got to use his, you know, his wiliness. Yeah. It's like sending a featherweight boxer against the heavyweight, you know.
But you got it, you know.
And
Munch is motivated.
Oh, yeah, he is motivated.
Yeah. And who overhears this plan to kill the king, Marion, in the background, and they see that she might have overheard it. Right. She runs upstairs. She talks to Bess. She writes a note. Mm-hmm. She's like, "Okay, we got to warn Robin. The king is here." Blah blah blah. And then, who knocks on the door? But Basil Rathbone.
Right.
Yeah, I guess hides the note in this little case, and Basil walks in. Man, he knows that note's in that case.
Yeah, he puts it right on the case. He's toying with her.
Yeah.
You're very charming, Lady Marion, but not exactly clever. For instance, you couldn't possibly have failed to overhear what Prince John and I were talking about just now. Oh, no, no, no. Please don't trouble to deny it. And your first thought as Richard's loyal ward was to warn him. Hmm? Am I not right?
Well, how could I warn Richard?
How did Locksley and his men arrange his escape from hanging after the archery match? Someone here in the castle must have got word to him.
That's ridiculous.
And you do intend to warn him, don't you? Don't you?
No.
And then opens up the case, and now you have committed treason.
Right.
Yeah. And they put Maid Marian on trial.
Oh, yeah.
What's interesting in that scene is that she thinks she's safe because she is a ward of the king.
Right.
And John's like, well,
not for long.
Not for long.
Which is weird because they say 48 hours. That kind of took me out of the movie a little bit because I wasn't sure how they were gauging time back during that time. You know, I'm sure they didn't have clocks or anything like that, or watches rather. So when they said 48 hours, like, that's such a random 48 hours. Okay.
Twice around the sun, though.
Yeah. That I would have accepted. Yes.
You're saying this movie might not be accurate.
No.
Yeah, we're not too concerned with the time frame right
that's
now.
True.
Bess, the lady in waiting, she runs off. She finds Much, who's going to warn Robin. Yeah. We hear about Dickon, and then we get to this moment you were talking about that I've been talking about too. Much jumps out of that tree, man. He goes toe-to-toe with Dickon.
And you don't know what's great is, again, Curtis was smart enough to, like, what happened?
Yeah.
Was he successful? You know?
Especially when you see Much again, who's lying in a heap on the ground. You don't know if he's alive or dead.
No, it's I think that's a brilliant choice.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah, I totally agree. We're back with Robin. And who shows up but these monks in black robes, which, of course, we know is Richard in disguise. And the merry men appear, and we are taking them. And there's this great sort of banter where it seems like Robin's trying to find out, what side are you on?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and once he kind of hears that he says, you know, do you love Richard?
Are you friendly to our good King Richard? I love no man better.
And then Robin's like, okay, you're one of the team. Come on and join us. At which point,
and we're only going to take half your stuff. We're not going to take all of it. We're going to take 30 instead of 60.
Well, this is the problem with robbing from the rich.
It's like Colonel Parker with Elvis. I'm going to get half.
It's not a bad deal. Robin is going off with Richard and the Merry Men, and they're talking about King John.
Right.
And Richard says, "Oh, so you blame King John?" And Robin says, "No, I blame Richard."
"No, I blame Richard. His task was here at home, defending his own people instead of deserting them to fight in foreign lands."
"What, you condemn Holy Crusades?"
"Aye, I'll condemn anything that leaves the task of holding England for Richard to outlaws like me."
Right.
And it's such an important moment.
That is.
Richard shouldn't have left. He shouldn't have gone. His place was here, being king of this kingdom, not going off to the Crusades. And I think that's key for the transfer. Richard thinking about himself and thinking about his relationship with
Robin. If you think about it, it's one of the first kind of instances where we get a nice definition of the difference between church and state.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, what's more important here?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Let's separate the two, and one's... this is that, and this is that, you know.
Yeah.
This is not the... because he's basically saying, well, but this is for the Crusades. This is for the church. And it's like, yeah, but, you know.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And what's the job of a
charity
king?
Starts at home, you know.
Yeah. Is the king... is the country exist to serve the king, or does the king exist to serve the country? Yeah.
Right.
You know? It's a profound moment, I think, for Richard, both in how he thinks about himself and also how he thinks about
Robin Hood. Very apropos today. I mean, yes. Obviously. I mean, absolutely. Without, you know, drawing a direct connection, it's like, wow, this is kind of timely.
Mm. Well, you know, both in King Arthur and in Robin Hood, there's this idea of service to the greater good,
right.
Of might for right, you know, of doing what is the correct thing even when it's hard.
Yeah.
Those are values that we need to continue to talk about.
Yeah.
Now we find Much, and he's wounded, he's beaten up, but apparently he's won,
yeah.
Right.
Which is great. And we go back to the Merry Men, and Will says, and Much explains that the king is in town. And so something else I found out that's interesting, they shot a whole sequence that's not in the movie, which is that they were, they had an archery competition, which they are shot all this, archery competition between Richard's men and the Merry Men. And then apparently Little John and King Richard have a fist fight, like as for fun,
oh
a competition.
Wow.
And then at the end of Richard beats Little John, and then Robin is like, well, try me. And they're about to fight. And that's the moment that Will Scarlet shows up.
Oh, wow.
And if you look at it, because I looked at it again, you could see Robin and Richard kind of facing each other right when Will rides
that's
in.
That's what he edited is, right?
Yeah, and they cut all that out.
Wow.
Which I find really, like, I kind of want to see that.
I'd love to see the old footage of that.
Yeah, I'd love to see it. And so we hear that Richard is here, and that Prince John's going to try to kill him. And so Robin's like, okay, get the men. You go here and you go here. We're going to have this plan. And Richard says, that's okay. Richard's going to be all right. And I know where he is. And Robin goes, where is he? And the moment he says, he's here, and takes off the cloak.
Oh, yeah. That's fantastic.
You don't need to search for Richard, Robin. He's in good hands. The best in England. What do you mean? Where is he? Here.
I will say something about this moment, which is that, like I said, I hadn't seen the movie in a long time. And when it started, I kind of went, is this going to be too cheesy for me? Like, it's really, you know, it's like it's really corny. Mm. And by this point, I was in.
Yeah.
I was
100%.
It had totally won me over.
I'm choking up thinking about
that.
I mean, they got because they're wearing the stuff with the cross on the shirts, and it's like that's the Crusaders, you know.
And there's something about the true king has arrived.
Yeah,
that's we all want the true king to arrive.
Right.
Tell me about it.
Yeah, I mean, and I think about it again. We go back to King Arthur. King Arthur has that exact moment.
Yep.
You pull the sword from the stone, and this is the true. Now the person who's the just, kind, honest, brave, the real guy who's going to make everything better, he's here.
Right.
Man, that's...
And that actor was great that played Richard.
Yeah,
because he kind of had that stature about him.
Yep.
He's like, you know, he reeked regalness, you know.
Right. And he's only in the last quarter of the film, so you want to cast an actor that conveys that by sight just immediately,
exactly.
You know?
He just seemed like the guy, the head guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they all take a knee to him, which I think is great. It's a great moment, shot from above. Just brilliant the way he laid that out. Yeah.
Well, because, and that's what's so interesting about the character of Robin Hood. He's only being a thief and a rebel because Richard's not here.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. He can't wait to give it all up and just go back to the crib, you know.
Yeah.
Hang with Marion.
Yeah. Well, and unfortunately, That's what we find out, is that Marion is about to be executed.
Yeah.
We can't do a frontal assault on the castle. We don't have any... we don't have an army. And Robin, being the sneak, this is his only good plan in the whole movie. He goes, let's go get the bishop. And they're all now all in their black robes, marching up with the bishop to the castle. Got a knife in the bishop's back saying, smile.
Yeah, and here's your script. They tell him what to say. I love that.
We're getting Marion. There's this beautiful shot of Marion in the cell, which is very painterly. Like, that's a really lovely shot. Mm. John and Sheriff and Guy, they're all getting ready. This is all going to go great. In walks the procession with the bishop and all of Robin and his men. And we're going to have the coronation. And man, the bishop really takes it to King John.
Mm. Yeah.
By what authority do you, John Lackland, Prince of England, claim to be crowned this day sovereign of the realm?
By right of blood succession, according to the law of the realm.
Is it of your own free will that you thus depose your brother, Richard the Lionheart of England?
And this is not what the script was supposed to be.
And Prince John is mad.
Well,
like,
sure,
he's
yeah.
like offended that the bishop is going, like, what are you asking me these questions for? And this, because I'm supposed to be king because I am the brother. Blah, blah. And so it's just like it raises the stakes before you even get to the battle. So it's brilliant.
Yeah.
And they go, oh, well, Richard's dead. And then again, this reveal.
Richard no longer exists. From this moment forward, I, John, am king of England.
Aren't you a little premature, brother?
Richard, the Lionheart!
I kind of think that Robin should have shut the hell up in this scene. Like, Richard has revealed himself, and everyone went, oh my God, that's Richard. And Robin went, ha-ha, it's me too. and now we're instantly into that fight
scene. Yeah, well, the movie is called Robin Hood.
Fair point. It's a fair point. And immediately, Basil, Guy of Gisborne, rushes Robin, and we get the sword fight we've been waiting our
whole
movie
to see. Yeah,
great
sword fight. One of the great sword fights.
It is. It's so important in the history of sword fights because they were really different before then. Mm-hmm. The fight choreographer is Fred Cavins, and he choreographed everything. Captain Blood, Mark of Zorro, all this stuff. And it's gorgeous. All the going up and down the stairs, right. The levels, the...
Kicking over the tables. Yeah.
I mean, this is it. This is the cool sword fighting stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really, really well done.
And didn't lose the comedic aspect of it, because you have much with his, hitting people on the head with his, so that keeps you not feeling too serious about what's happening. So
exactly.
It's brilliant balance, yeah.
Yeah, and you're getting Little John, you're getting everything that we wanted out of this action sequence.
Absolutely.
And it's interesting, too, there are moments in this where you can really see how good Basil is. Mm-hmm. There's a Perry riposte, which is like, oh, that dude's fast.
Oh, yeah, no, he's very good. Yeah, Flynn talked about that. He just, he was real good.
Yeah, he had to lose a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, my favorite one, and I think we brought it up before in the Cinephiles, is, which someday I do want to do is Basil with Danny Kaye in The Court Jester.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
I love that movie. And that sword fight is really good, too.
That is good.
Yeah.
That is good.
Well, the guy who choreographed, he said he didn't want it to look like fencing anymore, because that's what it had been before with Douglas Fairbanks, all those people. So he wanted to kind of create a new style that was more realistic.
Yeah.
And this was the way to do it. And Basil Rathbone, you said.
It's funny, because even when I was in an acting school in the 60s, they still taught fencing in the acting school.
Yes.
That was they figured actors should know how to fence. I thought, even, Robin.
Have you used it?
They got, hell no. That's what I mean. We got past, Robin Hood got past that back in the 30s. You know, so what are we doing fencing for? But I think it was more to just become aware of your body and just kind of the formality of all that. I mean, I'm glad we did it, but it's it wasn't called upon to use it much, though.
I want to see that Criminal Minds where you fence.
Yeah. I'm going to work that into an episode.
Unsub. Yeah. Fencing the unsub.
On guard.
On guard, unsub.
We could do this.
All right, I'm in. Yeah, I think we're gonna put a request in for this,
please.
I was watching a couple times. The sword fight ends very abruptly.
Mm-hmm. I was just gonna say the same thing. Is the one thing about it is it's kind of like the climax of the sword fight is not the best it could have been in terms of dramatic impact. But it's sufficient. It's good.
Here's what I think it is. Because I was thinking about, why did they do it that way? Is that there's a moment in the middle of the sword fight where Guy loses his sword. And in the classic heroic thing, Robin gives him back his sword.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Which, by the way, when I have sword fights to the death with people, I'm not giving anyone back their sword.
No,
sorry.
You're done.
Yeah,
that's
sorry.
It.
I won. And then there's a moment right near the end where they're up against the wall and Guy reaches for his dagger and tries to stab Robin Hood. And what I think it is, and in the next second, Robin kills him in this really abrupt way.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think it is that Guy violated the rules of honor by going to the dagger. Yeah. And Robin was having fun. He was having one of his fun sword fights like he always does.
Right.
And now it's like, oh, no, no, game's over. You're dead.
Yes.
That's the explanation I can't. I don't know if that's true.
I like that explanation. I'll buy that. I think that's good. When I see it again, I'll look at it with that in mind.
Mm. Yeah. And the stunt is great when he goes right over the side. That's a huge stunt. Yeah. Yeah, going right over the side.
That stunt
guy
broke something. I forget. There are a lot of guys breaking things.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's a big one.
It's just carpet down there.
I look like they have, it bounced a little bit. They had a little padding on it. It's still a big fall.
Oh, yeah.
Still, they didn't have like good high fall stuff.
No airbags.
No. Robin rescues Marion's, and then we have this great shot of swords being laid down on the shields on this beautiful crane shot. That's, you know, as symbolic a war is over shot as you can get.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Richard's the king. He banishes John. And then he also, after banishing John, he has this line where he says, I further banish from my realm all injustices and oppression.
Of course. Why wouldn't he?
Wow. That guy is a good king.
Yeah.
Robin swears allegiance, and he gets a pardon for his merry men. And Richard's like, isn't there anything else you might want?
Yeah.
Hint, hint.
Right.
And then he gets Marion.
Yeah. I know. And then that last line, I love when they're all in the huddle and he sneaks out. May I obey all your edicts with such, you know, whatever.
With equal pleasure.
With equal pleasure.
May I obey all your commands with equal pleasure, sire.
It's a perfect movie.
Yeah.
It really is a perfect movie. There's no one part of the movie that I would say, oh, they should change this or this is not this. It sits down here or something.
Mm. No.
It never sits down.
Right.
So, John, what are your final thoughts?
Yeah, I absolutely love revisiting this film for this podcast. It was nice to, because I think it's been about a year since I bought it on Blu-ray, because it came out with a remastered version, which is fantastically beautiful. And when you read about how they created this film and the Technicolor and how it was laborious and bringing all those cameras, you saw a lot of effort and love put into this film. And it comes through on screen when you're watching it. And I also think it's 1938. We're just out of the Depression. FDR is about to come in. There's a lot here that you can explore about what's happening in our current country at that time, socially and politically, if you're looking through this whole film, which I think is what always decorates the great ones. There's always something they're saying beyond the happiness and the joy and the fun. There's something they're saying about what Joe just brought up, the separation of church and state. It's subtle. It's there. You don't have to make a big deal out of it. If you catch it, you catch it. You don't need to catch it. And I think that's what the amazing, great films do. And this is one of them. And Errol Flynn, this is the height. Every fantastic, great actor has one film that they are 100% known for. This is him at his height. Olivia de Havilland, all just so beautiful. And it's unfortunate when you read later on what happens to him later. But here you can enjoy him captured in pristine form at the height of his joy. And it's a vibrant film. If you're listening to us, because some people listen to us before they see the film, I encourage you 1,000% to go and watch this. If you can see it in a theater in a Revival House, do so. If you can't, get the Blu-ray and watch it on the biggest screen as you can, because it is a fantastic film that you will enjoy. And I will challenge you to not walk away with a smile on your face when you finish watching it.
Right. So. I think for me, the thing I kept thinking about is that we go to see movies for different reasons. You know, sometimes we go to see movies to learn profound lessons. Sometimes we go to see movies to laugh our asses off. Sometimes we go to see movies to get scared to death. And sometimes we go to see movies to get a sense of the adventure, a sense of the possible, a sense of the heroic. And this is a heroic film. A realistic film? No. A heroic film? Right. Yes. Mm. And the thing is that we need to see those great, crazy, unrealistic heroes sometimes, because we don't have enough of that in our lives, you know? It's great to see the realistic heroes. It's great to see the tragedies. All those things help, but sometimes you need this. Sometimes you need Robin Hood to swing on a rope and say, welcome to Sherwood.
Yeah.
You know, you need to see that, because we got to feel like, you know, we can be heroes. Mm-hmm. And that's worth it.
Yep.
Yeah, that's great. I think what you both said is really, really terrific, because I agree with both your comments in every respect. I mean, it's escapism in its, you know, greatest form, and to me, and also it's a testament to a time of our country. I mean, we've been around a relatively short period of time in terms of world history.
Yeah.
So, you know, 200 plus years, as opposed to hundreds and thousands in some cultures. And because of that, and I think even just in my lifetime, I think of where our strengths as a country has lain in the sense that when I was a kid, U.S. Steel. Steel was the thing. Cars. We built cars better than anybody. Yeah. We did a lot of stuff better than a lot of people. Now, jump cuts, 2017. We're not necessarily known to being the greatest steel manufacturers. Right. We're not known as being necessarily the greatest car manufacturers. We've lost all of that. But the one thing we still do, we make movies better than anybody. I mean, if we say, when I say better, I mean on a scale going from the littlest kind of independent stuff to the huge stuff, that to the point now where when I was first getting out in the business, the foreign box office wasn't that big a deal. Right. They kind of was kind of a thing. And even the Golden Globes, they thought about it as like a joke award and all that. Now all of a sudden, everything has taken on such importance because the foreign, in many cases, especially with films like of this genre,
exactly,
it's bigger on a world scale than it is on. They don't even care what it does here in a way. It's almost like, yeah, if it does mediocre here, fine. We'll really make our cash over the rest of the world. And so to me, this is like a foreshadowing of that. In other words, this movie is the one that they can put up as one of the ones to say, well, this is what caused that to happen, because it lives on, just like what you said. Yeah. It's like this film shot in the 30s. I mean, it was shot before World War II.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Yet, here were three guys living in 2017 talking, getting excited about this movie that we saw. And yep. It's like, you know, it's antiquated in terms of the technology that's way films are done today and stuff. But to me, I'll take one of these over 100. You know, sometimes a movie that's made yesterday that doesn't have the script, the heart, the music, the whole, you know, doesn't, just like music, like a band. Some are one hit wonders, some are classics, you know. This is a classic for a reason. And to me, being in the business myself, as we all are in the business, I'm proud to say this is an industry that we still pretty much at a gold standard. This movie is one of the examples of it.
Yeah.
That's great.
That's great.
That's fantastic.
So that's what we think of The Adventures of Robin Hood. Of course, we always want to hear what you think. You can visit us on Facebook at The Cinephiles. That's CINE-FILES. You can subscribe to us on YouTube, on Stitcher, on iTunes. You can leave comments. You can leave reviews. We love to hear them. If you want to reach me, you can always reach me at SR Morris. John, where can they reach you?
You guys can always reach me at The Roca Says. You can see all the shows I'm hosting and co-hosting. Also, contribute to our Patreon. You know, Steve
Absolutely.
And I, we started it a couple of months ago. It's really been growing every month. The contributions from all of you, just thank you so much for the comments and the compliments. And of course, we will listen to the movies that you are recommending and consider it. But it's a great way to keep us doing the show, because it's not an inexpensive show to do. And so we appreciate any dime. And there's always a bunch of awards and then a bunch of amounts that you can contribute that help to the show. And so we appreciate it greatly.
And I can be reached in Sherwood Forest with my merry men and my merrier women.
So if you want to visit Joe, go to Sherwood Forest.
Yes. Or www.joemontaigne.com.
There you go.
Also, that's the Sherwood Forest of the internet.
Exactly.
Well, I just want to thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been so much talking to you about this.
You know
movie.
What's funny is I did not watch the movie again. I decided I'm going to come in cold and just kind of relive this through the lab. And I probably haven't seen the movie in, I don't know, maybe 20 years, maybe.
Right.
But what I did do is I bought, you talked about that Blu-ray version.
Blu-ray.
That made me buy a Blu-ray player. Because when it came out, they said, and Robin Hood's going to be released in Blu-ray. I said, Blu-ray? This sounds interesting. What's Blu-ray? And I find out it was just like super net way to see movies. I said, well, shit, I got to go buy this. So I went out, I bought the Robin Hood copy as soon as it came out, and then bought the player.
Yeah.
But you know what? I haven't even looked at it yet. I just wanted to have it.
Yeah.
But I have it. But now I'm all excited again. I am going to see. So in a way, I'm glad we did this, because it got me all jazzed up. Like, yeah, I want to hear it again. I want to see it. And that's why I purposely didn't want to see it before talking to you guys. I wanted to kind of, because I know it so well. I mean, I've seen it. God, I think about it. I've been watching it since I've been 10 years old, maybe. Yeah. You know, so
you're going to go home. You're going to put that Blu-ray in, and the colors is going to be so amazing. What you're going to see,
I know.
It looks
because my strongest memory of it was the time I saw it on a big screen in the Clark Theater, like in Chicago, and I've got a pretty good system now at home. I got a surround sound and the whole deal, and I got a really big. I got a theater, indoor house, in home theater. So I'm. this is going to happen very soon.
Good. Good. Well, let us know what you think of it. Well, yeah, I will. We want to hear.
I will.
And I want to say one last thing. This has been a personal joy of mine because I've been a personal fan of your acting since Homicide. So, like, to me, it's just a pleasure to be in the same room with Joey Zaza and all the other, and a massive fan of Criminal Minds as well. So this has been a great joy.
My pleasure. You know, so this was I had a good time.
Great.
Good. All right. Well, I think that's it for this week. We will see you next time on The Cinephiles.